We're starting in Job chapter 8, verses 1 through 7. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, "How long will you go on saying these things? Your words are a blast of wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? Since your children sinned against him, he gave them over to their rebellion. But if you earnestly seek God and ask the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, then he will move even now on your behalf and restore the home where your righteousness dwells. Then, even if your beginnings were modest, your final days will be full of prosperity." Now we're in Job chapter 19, verses 21 through 27. "Have mercy on me, my friends, have mercy, for God's hand has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? I wish that my words were written down, that they were recorded on a scroll or were inscribed in stone forever by an iron stylus and lead. But I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the end he will stand on the dust. Even after my skin has been destroyed, I will see God in my flesh. I will see him in myself. My eyes will look at him and not as a stranger. My heart longs within me." This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good morning. My name is Tom. I'm a part of the lead team here at Imprint Kenmore. It's a privilege to open God's word with you. And as you heard, we've got a doozy in front of us. We've been in the book of Job for the past month now, and we've been learning that the book of Job is not primarily about giving us a history lesson on what happened to a good guy a long time ago. It's not primarily a book that's supposed to give us good morals for positive Christian outcomes, but instead, it's a book of wisdom that is meant to comfort those who are afflicted, experiencing suffering, going through it. It is a book of wisdom meant to equip those who will go through it with them, and it's meant to lead us to wisdom and worship. And so that's what we're doing. We're looking for comfort in the book of Job. We're looking for wisdom so that we can be people that are faithful to God in the midst of suffering and in the presence of suffering. I'm glad Kinsey prayed as she had. We live in a very uncomfortable time, right? It is strange. It's deeply troubling personally. And what we see surrounding us in our country is a microcosm of the way of the world. The injustice runs rampant, and it is often a cause for suffering. Now, Job is a man who is experiencing injustice himself. He has been blameless, upright, and yet he has become the target for the enemy of God and his people. And so the enemy has taken away everything he has. Even though Job has been upright and blameless, he has seen the death of his children, the loss of his wealth, and the loss of his status, and even the loss of his health in the context that we are reading today. Now, if you were with us, you know that he has three friends that came from the east. They come with the purpose of comforting him. They want to be with him. And they're really good guys. They're wise. They're wealthy. They are peers of Job's, and they've come with good intentions. And yet, they are miserable. I think one of the beautiful things about the book of Job for me is that it provides comfort by validating. It validates my experience, not just of suffering and how it feels to suffer, how it feels to cry out with that forlorn why, but also what it feels like to suffer with some friends who mean well, but are just bozos, you know? It validates that experience. It says, you are not alone, Tom. And the book of Job also says to you, you are not alone in your suffering. The way that you feel has been felt before. The things you experience has been felt before. And so the book of Job is giving us wisdom for knowing how to walk through suffering, but also how to walk with others through suffering. And what I'd like to do, because it'd be unmanageable to preach through Job chapter 8 through 10, 18 through 19, and 25 through 26, is that I'm going to take a theme out of this section that is going to equip us for solidarity with the suffering. And that's why I was glad that Kinsey prayed as she had, because it kind of sets us up for how do we suffer with others well? It's one thing to know how to suffer yourself, But how do we suffer with others well? And solidarity, I think, is the key. Solidarity is, instead of providing answers, it provides presence. Solidarity says, I know how you feel. That must be so hard. I'm so sorry. Solidarity disadvantages itself and says, instead of going out on a Thursday night with my friends, I'm going to make a meal and be a part of a meal train and to take a hot pot of something delicious to somebody that's down in it. Solidarity is the process by which we identify with a person in their suffering. And we'll go into it more. But the question is, why is solidarity with the suffering so difficult? Why do Job's friends biff it so much? You know, look at Job chapter 8, verse 2. Bildad starts off. So Job has just poured out his heart. Eliphaz has spoken, hey, man, this is like a little too much for us, and also I have some answers for you. And Job says, that's not going to help me. And then he turns to God in prayer and says, what have I ever done to you? Why not show me mercy? Why not just forgive me and let me be done with it? Why not just kill me? Let's be over with it. And so then Bildad starts in Job chapter 8, verse 2. How long will you go on saying these things? Your words are a blast of wind. Is that solidarity? You're full of hot air, but Job, how long do we have to listen to you? And he's uncomfortable with what Job has said. And so being uncomfortable with somebody's suffering creates an impossibility for solidarity. Like, when we're uncomfortable, we can't enter into it. We can't identify with them. It creates a gap. I think one of the things that happens for us is that we become so uncomfortable with the suffering of others that we withdraw. Instead of drawing near with solidarity, we withdraw. And then when we go through our own suffering, we find ourselves alone and isolated. Nobody stands to be in solidarity with us. So Bildad is uncomfortable, but it gets even worse. In the second cycle in Job chapter 18, verses 2 through 3, he says, how long until you stop talking? Show some sense, and then we can talk. Calm down. Like, cool your emotions. Don't be so emotional, Job. Why are we regarded as cattle, as stupid in your sight? And so Bildad is not just uncomfortable, but he's offended. He's offended by Job's suffering and what Job has said about his suffering. Now remember, Job is expressing truth about what he feels, about what he thinks, and what he's experiencing. And sometimes what he thinks is at odds with what he feels. But he says them both. He's expressing truth. And so when we enter into suffering with others, they might say things we know they don't believe, but they're suffering. It's difficult. And Bildad says, this is a bunch of hot air. You're offending our sensibilities. You're offending us. And we don't want anything to do with that. You're treating us like we're stupid. So where does this offense, where does this uncomfortable posture towards suffering come from? And I think we find it in Bildad's theology. So if you look with me in Job chapter 8, verses 3 through 7, we're going to see what Bildad believes. And I think this is the foundation from which he brings his resources to comfort Job. And what we're going to see is that he has no resources to bring to Job's situation. He says this, does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? And then this real doozy, since your children sinned against him, he gave them over to their rebellion. Ugh. Telling somebody that they got what they had coming to them, or that the person they lost had what they had coming to them, is just not a good idea. It hurts. I think that would be a hot tip for today. If somebody has lost something, accusing that person is a bad posture. But he goes on. He says, if you earnestly seek God and ask the Almighty for mercy, if you're pure and upright, then he will move even now on your behalf and restore the home where your righteousness dwells. Then, even if your beginnings were modest, your final days would be full of prosperity. So he's got kind of three main points. God is just. If you do the right thing, you get the blessing. If you do the wrong thing, you get punished. Your kids did the wrong thing, illustration, and so they were punished. And then he says, but if you do the right thing again, happily ever after. He's painting little silver linings around Job's dark cloud. It's just a brutal scene. But it's the theology that underpins his discomfort and his offense. It's that retribution theology. What it makes God into is something that fits in a box. It makes God into someone who is understandable, somebody who is consistent, who is ultimately controllable. If I do the right things, God owes me. And if I don't get what I have coming to me, then there's either something wrong with God or there's something wrong with me. But for Bildad, he's like, there can't be anything wrong with God, so it must be Job. He goes on in Job chapter 8:8-10, and says, look, I didn't just make this stuff up. He says, ask the previous generation, pay attention to what their ancestors discovered. Since we were born only yesterday and know nothing, our days on earth are but a shadow. Will they teach you, or will they not teach you and tell you and speak from their understanding? In other words, this isn't something I've come up with through careful study and personal research. This is the tradition of wisdom handed down to us. He is appealing to traditional wisdom. Now, traditional wisdom is great. If you have read the Bible, you've encountered traditional wisdom. The book of Proverbs is the biggest collection of traditional wisdom where it's like, just clearly, this is what it is. Proverbs is super awesome. I was going to assign it, but I want to keep us in Job. It's not assigned reading. Read Job. I'll assign Proverbs later. But Proverbs has a bunch of really good ideas. Like, don't get involved in a fight between two people when you don't have a dog in it, you know? A diagnosis, like a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool to his folly, right? These are, like, really common sense traditional wisdom sayings. And what's really cool about Proverbs is it's not just a bunch of stuff that came out of Israel. They're borrowing from Babylonian, Ugaritic, from Assyrian wisdom traditions. They're collecting wisdom from the entire ancient Near East and saying, yeah, we'll appropriate this because in general, it's true. Traditional wisdom says, in general, these are the skills you need to live in the world as it is, especially when the rules don't apply. But what Bildad has done is he's said, that's all there is. It's not generally true, it's always true. And so what he's done is he's made his God small. And what happens when we make our God small? When we make our God somebody we can control, somebody we can understand, somebody we can manage, is that we become moralists. If I do the right thing, I get good things. I'm a good person, that's why my life is going so well. And if things aren't going well for you, well, it's obviously because you've got a sin problem. And sometimes we'll point it out like the friends have. Sometimes we'll make it up like the friends do. Sometimes we'll just sit back in judgment and it'll remove us further and further from relationship with the other people. And we become moralists, people that are the police of another person's behavior or thought patterns. We put ourselves in the place of judgment, which is rather easy because, remember, God is small. He's in the box. We can control him, and we can use him however we want, and this is what Bildad does. He uses his very small God to beat Job over the head, to try and convince Job that his response to suffering is unrighteous, and further evidence that he was wicked all along and that he deserved it. You know, we say we don't believe this, but who of the parents in the room don't have an idea somewhere deep in the back of your head that if you raise your kids right, they will turn out okay? And then what happens if they don't? Either deep shame or blaming. Well, they fell in with the wrong crowd. Or they went to college and got indoctrinated with something that I don't like. Either way, we remove ourselves. Shame, we hide. And so we remove ourselves from solidarity, from relationship. Or blame, we push the person away. It's their fault. We do this with our lives. We say we don't believe in the prosperity gospel. And yet, when suffering comes, it's the refrain from A Serious Man, the Coen brothers film about the book of Job. I didn't do anything. Why is this happening? God owes me. God owes me. Why is he letting this happen? I think when you find yourself in suffering or you see somebody else in suffering, do you blame them or do you blame God? Just a brief diagnostic for your life. If you're blaming them or you're blaming God, then there is something wrong with your idea about who God is. Now, here's the problem. Job has a bigger problem because his God is too big. Look in Job chapter 9, verse 2. After Bildad gives his theology, he says, "Yeah, I know that what you've said is true, that God is just, but how can a person be justified before God?" He says, "Your theology is right, but," in Job chapter 9, verses 21 through 22, "I'm blameless. I don't care about myself. I renounce my life. It's all the same. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked." In other words, there's something wrong with the system. Yeah, God is just, but I've been just, and yet, this is my experience. So, something doesn't add up. He directs his complaint to God in chapter 10 and asks him, "Why is this happening? I'm innocent." He says in verse 7, "Even though you know that I'm not wicked and that there is no one who can rescue you from your power, why are you doing this?" And so Job directs his complaint to God, not about God, which is a key distinction. When we judge God and blame God, are we doing it to his face because he can handle it? Or are we talking to other people about him? Remember, at the end of the book, God comes on the scene and says to Eliphaz and the friends, "Hey, you haven't spoken rightly about me as my friend Job has, my servant Job has." And so Job says untrue things to God, but he doesn't talk about him like the friends do. He takes his complaint directly to the top. But here's the problem. Job's God is too big. In chapter 26, verses 12 through 14, he says, he goes through a whole poem about how majestic and beautiful God is, how powerful he is, how he rules the universe. And he says, "By his power, he stirred the sea, and by his understanding, he crushed Rahab." Now, Rahab is Leviathan. It's the sea serpent. It's the chaos dragon. It's the Satan. "By his breath, the heavens gained their beauty, and his hand pierced the fleeing serpent." So he's beautiful. He's big. He limits chaos and evil. He is just. But in verse 14, "These are but the fringes of his ways. How faint is the word we hear of him. Who can understand his mighty thunder?" It's like Job has stood on the edge of the ocean and dipped his toes into the transcendent majesty of God, and says, "This is powerful." Have you ever stood at the edge of the ocean? Have you seen the waves like crashing? And it's just like, whoa, power. And yet you're just on the edge of the shore. That's what Job says. These are just the fringes of his ways. What we know is that God is majestic and transcendent and massive. And yet that's just the beginning. See, God's incomprehensibility is troubling to Job. He feels inaccessible. He feels silent. How can I get to him? Now, let me show you how. And we'll step back. This is a little teacher moment. The dialogues have this kind of pattern that we talked about last time. There are three sections. Eliphaz speaks, Job speaks. Bildad speaks, Job speaks. Zophar speaks, Job speaks. And then the pattern repeats for a second round of dialogues. Same group. And then in the third, everything kind of falls apart. There's a little bit of the pattern, but Zophar or Bildad loses the track of the argument, and Zophar just stops speaking altogether. Now, throughout that pattern, the friends start with, "Here's our theology. If you do the right thing, God will reward you. Turn back to him," and happy ending. They start getting offended in the second. They dig their heels in. They keep on saying the same stuff, and then they start accusing Job. And by the third, they're just fully entrenched. It's a circular, entrenched, they're stuck. They can't move forward. Their little small God can't deal with the reality of the situation, so they just stay where they're at. It's really frustrating to Job. Job, on the other hand, doesn't stay stuck. Sure, initially he starts with lament. "I wish I'd never been born. I wish I was dead. I don't understand anything." But as the dialogues progress, he changes. We see a character that moves from a good man to a wise man, from someone who is lamenting to someone who is challenging, who is praying, from somebody that feels like there is no hope to somebody who knows there is and just doesn't know how it's going to happen, from somebody who is self-focused and everything about their suffering drives them in, to somebody who's other-focused and starts looking in solidarity to others who are suffering, especially the poor, especially the vulnerable. Job's character progresses. And I think that gives us just the structure, gives us hope that honest suffering in the presence of God is not, though it feels like we're stuck, is not stuck. It moves us forward. God moves us forward. Look what he says. In three movements, there are these three key points in the three sections that move Job forward. Job 9, 32 through 33 says, "For he is not a man like me, that I can answer him, that we can take each other to court." So again, transcendent, my God is too big. "And yet there is no mediator between us to lay his hand on both of us." He has this intuition that there is somebody that must bridge the gap between them, somebody that must advocate for him. Job's God is too big, and he feels like he's been dragged into court, standing before a judge on charges he doesn't understand, and without an advocate, without a lawyer that can explain the charges and can advocate for him to God. And then in chapter 16, 19 through 21, he looks for a witness to his suffering. He says, "Even now my witness is in heaven and my advocate is in the heights. My friends scoff at me as I weep before God. I wish that someone might argue for a man with God just as anyone would for a friend." He's looking for somebody to bridge that gap, somebody to argue his case to God. And then he culminates in Job chapter 19. And from here on, Job's character changes. It's really beautiful. If we were reading right through it, you'd notice it. It's fantastic. Go read it this afternoon. Job 19, 25 through 27, and this is a famous verse. It says, "But I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the end he will stand on the dust," or on the earth. "Even after my skin has been destroyed, yet I will see God in my flesh. I will see him myself, my eyes will look at him, and not as a stranger. My heart longs within me. My Redeemer lives." Okay, now I'll go back into the teacher spot. So Christians, that's most of us. Not all of us, but most of us, have been like, "Oh, this is a proof text for Jesus. He is looking ahead to Jesus. That's not what's going on. I know it's totally disappointing. But you can get there. You can get there, and we will. But what he's saying is, God is my Redeemer. I need an advocate, but ultimately God is my Redeemer. And he is alive. And he will vindicate me." And what's really interesting is that up until this point, Job has talked a lot about what he wishes for, what he hopes for, what he desires. But here he says, "I know." Not I think, not I hope, but I know. Somehow in Job's suffering, he has come to the conclusion that if suffering means anything, then there must be something and someone transcendent who is providing meaning to it. And that person is a Redeemer, and that person is Yahweh, his God. Now, what is a Redeemer? When I think of the word Redeemer, I think of Roald Dahl. I think of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I think of Charlie Bucket, who's got a golden ticket, right? And he won the prize, and he redeems the ticket, the golden ticket, for access into the good place to hang out with the good guy, to eat the good stuff, right? Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, am I alone? How often outside of coupons, do we really redeem anything anymore? Maybe if you play the scratch-offs or something, but like, redemption is such a strange word outside of the church. Inside the church, we use it a lot, and I still think we don't have any idea what it actually means, but redemption is just it's a weird word. What does it mean? And why is it so important to Job? Why does it make the difference for his character so that by the time he gets to chapter 24, he's in his own suffering, no longer self-focused, but identifying with the poor, identifying with the widow, identifying with the orphan, identifying with the person that's persecuted by the wealthy? What gives him the power at 19 to shift into this new way of looking at his own suffering in the context of the world? What gives him the power for solidarity? Well, in Genesis 1 and chapter 2, the very beginning, God makes everything. And therefore, as creator, he owns everything. Not like he bought it, but he made it. He is the rightful owner of everything. And that means you, that means me, that means these pews, that means the 1,000 cattle on the 7 hills. Like, everything that is belongs to the person who made it. And we encounter this word at the very end of Genesis, the book of Genesis, but it gets fleshed out in its meaning. What does redemption mean in the book of Exodus? So the way it goes is God creates everything, and he creates humans as beautiful co-rulers with him, and he wants to share his life, and he wants to share his rule with them. And they say, no thanks. I'd rather go my own way. And so they forfeit access to God's life, but also in the process, they give ownership over to their own sin and to this nefarious serpent in the garden that we now call Satan. They become owned by sin and death and evil, and they get lost. And it's just like this cascading ripple of awfulness until at some point God in Genesis chapter 12 says, I'm going to choose a family and they will become mine. And I'll make them into a great nation. And through them, I will redeem everybody. I will take back what's mine. And then that family grows. And then in Exodus, they become like a massive group of people. Not yet a nation, but God's people. But they're not owned by him anymore because a bad king rose up in Egypt and said, no, these are mine, and I'm going to make them slaves. And so I'm going to make them do what I want, and they don't belong to you anymore. And then God says, I'm not going to stand for that. And so he sends Moses and has a confrontation with this bad king, and in 10 acts of judgment, he says, I'm going to confront you with my power to try and take my people back. I want you to do the right thing, let my people go, and if you won't, more power, more judgment. Just amps up until you get to the 10th confrontation where God says, you've turned yourself over to death and my people are currently owned by one that doesn't actually have a claim. The only person that has a claim on any y'all at this point is death. And so I'm going to give you a choice. If you want to be freed, liberated, you're going to give up this life that will create a way out of slavery, not just to the bad king, but from death itself. And so this angel of death is flying over, and the people that trust God paint a blood on their doorposts. And through their trust, God recognizes them and prevents them from being redeemed by death. And he redeems them from death, and he redeems them out of Egypt. So redemption is the word that we use when we talk about somebody retrieving something or someone to its proper owner. And Job says, I have a redeemer, he's alive, and he will vindicate me. So who does Job belong to at this point? In his suffering, he thinks he belongs to death. His friends think he belongs to sin. He's currently trapped in this never-ending, like, circular dialogue that must be maddening. But ultimately, it's about those things. He feels like death has claimed ownership over him, and sin, though he did not commit it, has claimed ownership over him. And he says, because I have a redeemer who lives, I know that I will be vindicated. I know that he will take me back and retrieve me as his proper person. How does this change Job? When God redeems, he stands in solidarity with his people. When God redeems, he enters into their circumstances. He comes near. When God redeems, he gets involved. And so if Job has a redeemer, he's got a God that stands in solidarity with him. And it breaks that cycle of feeling self-focused on his own pain and suffering. And it liberates him not only from sin and death, but into a life that is bigger than just his own, where he can see his suffering as part of a pattern that other people in the world share, where he can move from somebody that is entirely consumed by his own pain to somebody who starts to begin to see the pain of those around him. He stands in solidarity with all who suffer, but especially the poor and oppressed. He begins to broaden his perspective. And I think this is how your Redeemer can change you. Why do we not stand in solidarity with those who suffer injustice? Is it because our God is too small, and so they must have done something to deserve it? Is it because our God is too small, and so that their suffering threatens and becomes uncomfortable? It might cost us something. Is it because our God is too small, and so it's offensive to see what they're going through and to be close to it? Remember, solidarity is coming close, identifying with another person or a people group. It is using our resources to comfort and to care for them. It is disadvantaging ourselves for their benefit. It's empathy or compassion, depending on your chosen word, as we talked about in Job chapter 2. It's saying, that must be so hard. I'm so sorry. Let me be with you. Let me cry with you. Let me take care of, you know, your house. Let me clean your place. Let me be with you in your suffering. That's solidarity. And that's what Job, having a Redeemer, moves towards. And that's what I think can move us towards solidarity. Not just with each other, but with our world. That we would see the suffering of this world as something we stand in solidarity with and identify with and care about and draw near to in whatever capacity you are able. And that's because we follow a man named Jesus of Nazareth, who claimed to be the incarnate Son of God. And early in his ministry, claimed to be the Redeemer, not just of Israel, God's people, but of all humanity. And claimed that the big problem wasn't political oppression of the Romans over Israel. The big problem wasn't just the injustices that we perpetrate on one another. But the big problem was sin, death, and the devil. And he said, I want to redeem you from that. I want to redeem your heart to be liberated from captivity to the self-focused, self-caring, selfish life. I want to liberate you from death so that you know that death is not the end, so you don't have to hoard your stuff. I want to liberate you from sin so that sin is no longer who you are, but who you are is as I say you are. You're not defined by your sin. You're not destined for death, and you're not in captivity to a devil who makes God out to be even worse. See, Jesus comes on the scene and says, I come to liberate you. And then, like the lamb at Passover, he offers his life as the way through, that anybody that would trust in his blood, anybody that would say, that's for me, anybody that would say, that's what my captivity cost my Savior, would by faith, trust, and commitment and relationship enter into captivity to God. That he would retrieve you from ownership from somebody who has no real claim on you and say, I alone have the legitimate claim on your life. And because God is both big and small in Jesus Christ, then he's somebody we can know. Not know everything about, but know nonetheless. He's somebody that is present and alive in a way that is way too mysterious for us to even, I think, comprehend. You can read very large books on the immanence of God in Jesus Christ and still come out just as confused. And that's because God, in a way, is a mystery. God is too big for us to understand because that, by definition, is what is required of a God. If your God is not the one revealed by Jesus Christ, then your God is either too big and abstract and just basically an idea, or he's too small. He's somebody you can fit into your little tiny heart to take care of your little tiny sin problem in your little tiny life, who will give you little tiny gifts when you do the right thing, but is ultimately unable to deal with your suffering when reality sets in. Is that your God? In Philippians 2, 7 through 8, the Apostle Paul says this: "He emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross." See, our Jesus doesn't just identify with us, but identifies as one of us. He becomes a human being. If that's not solidarity. In Colossians 1, 13 through 14, Paul says what he did when he redeemed us. He says he has rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son he loves. In him we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. We've been redeemed out of darkness, out of the kingdom of darkness, out of slavery to sin and death and the devil, and brought into the kingdom of God. Brought in as his rightful possession, brought in as sons and daughters who are no longer defined by our shame or our sin, but are defined by our King. If that is your God, then you are free to stand in solidarity with one another. You are free to stand in solidarity with all who face injustice across the whole globe, but especially our neighbors. You're free to stand in solidarity with those who live next door to you, who exist right next door to us, who live in your workplaces, your schools, to stand in solidarity with people who may not feel like they're suffering all that much, but in reality are currently owned by someone who has no legitimate claim on their life. Are you telling them about that? Are you sharing the good news that freedom and a new identity and a new family and a new hope and a new future is possible? That would be the first step in solidarity with them. Let me pray. Father, we are so grateful for your Son. Without him, you would be too big, too abstract, too mysterious for us to grasp. We would know only what you tell us, but how could we even understand that? But in your Son, Jesus, we see that you have become one of us and for us. And that humbles us and gives us courage to approach you as one who cares. If you were so loving as to come to be with us, then you are so loving to receive even the most difficult truths that we speak from our heart or our head or our will. I pray in this time, as we respond to you, that you would meet with us, that you would show us where we have made you too small or too big, where you show us what it means to follow your Son as disciples. I pray that you would heal us of our suffering, heal us of our sin, and heal us of our suspicions, and that you would liberate us into solidarity with all who suffer. Amen.